when you needed to tell ministers and male members of parliament what they were doing wrong and, you know, how they had to manage various women and one thing and another. Yeah, I mean, it was tough. And the mentoring, you know, to help those women back on track after dealing with us. And some of the leaders were quite hostile towards us because we, you know, we weren't being told by them.
Well, you were bad cop.
Yeah, yeah.
Welcome back to Herstory. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'm with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called WA their home. In episode 11, we meet Cheryl Davenport. Cheryl is responsible for ensuring women and their medical practitioners in WA were free of fear and prosecution if they chose to terminate their pregnancy. Because of Cheryl's work as a sitting Labor politician, abortion was removed from the state's criminal code. She's also worked in a number of different roles, including helping to mentor and usher in the next wave of female politicians, and, most recently, advising the Norfolk Island government. It's Season 2, Episode 11 of Herstory with Cheryl Davenport. This is Her Story. Let's start off with a little bit about your early childhood and growing up in the Peel region. Tell us what that was like for you. Where exactly did you grow up?
Well, I actually grew up in the township of North Stanlop. My parents had a small business, a car business, used and new cars. And I had all my schooling in primary school at North Stanlop Primary and then high school at Pinjarra. Played netball and, you know, all the school sports and all that sort of stuff locally. Still have friends from down there that I'm quite close to. In fact, my brother's currently living in New Zealand and he's back for a holiday at the moment. We're going down to have a Dunlop Day next Saturday. So, yeah, we still stay in pretty close contact. Mm. Largely because it was a small town and we all got on and knew each other and was pretty compact. It still is nice to have those connections.
It's nice to know that regardless of how long you live away from a place where you grew up, the feeling of going back. And
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it's home. To me, it, you know, while I've lived in Perth for a very long time, North Dunlop's home.
Mm. You mentioned that, and I have to ask you about it, playing netball. So many of the women in this podcast have played netball at some point in their life, so I feel like we've got a fantasy Hall of Fame netball team going on. I need to ask you, though, what position did you play?
Well, I played both centre and six, which was defence. So, yeah, mainly centre, because I'm small and I was relatively fast. Yeah, and I enjoyed it. And then as I sort of in my latter years, you know, I actually played basketball in Pinjarra when we got a basketball team going.
Fabulous. You know who else played centre for netball who we've spoken to for this podcast? Carmen Lawrence.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's the women of politics. It's wonderful. Speaking of politics, talk to me about sort of your family involvement in politics. Is that something that you grew up with in your house?
Pretty much. My dad actually ran as an independent for the seat of Murray. He ran against Ross McLarty, who was the former Premier of Western Australia, and people said he'd do his deposit, and he finished up polling, I don't know, something like 2,500 votes, because he was well known across the district and very prominent in the timber industry as a worker as much as anything. And then he ran several other times and he died in 1970. So I guess that's how I got involved. And after he died, I was actually the secretary of the Mandurah branch of the Labor Party in 1972, and I was approached by the then state secretary of the Labor Party, Joe Chamberlain, to actually come and be his assistant in the ALP head office, where I actually began work in 1973, just after the Whitlam government was elected.
Mm. How old were you at this time?
About 25, 26. I had to wind the business up and everything after my father died. Mm. Sort of so that, and I worked in the motor industry in Perth after that for several years. And anyway, I mean, the bottom line was they knew about me.
Sure.
And I sort of said to them, oh, I can't do that. You know, I haven't got a qualification. I haven't got this. I haven't got that. And I remember the state secretary then saying to me, I don't want your qualifications. You can learn them. We want your commitment.
Wow.
And that's how it started and went on from there, basically.
So coming into a role like that at such an interesting time, and I know that this is in state politics, but federally, the Whitlam government coming in, that's a pretty significant time in Australia's political history.
It was.
What was the talk around the state Labor office like at that
time? Oh, well, I mean, the state Labor office back then did everything. We ran federal campaigns as well as state campaigns. And previous to me going in to work in the party office, I'd kind of been involved in the state campaign and for the federal seat of Canning, of which Kim Beazley, as a uni student, was the campaign director.
Oh, my gosh.
So I ran the Pinjarra booth of the election day, handing out how to vote cards and scrutineering and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, I was involved and so it just went on, you know, and that's kind of, we didn't have a lot of staff. I think there were five of us in the office. And my first year in that office, I did a state conference, which was 5 days, and most of it was on the rules. We didn't do any policy, and we had a state election at the beginning of 1974, and we had to then have every second Monday night, when we didn't have state executive meetings, which we ran fortnightly, we actually had to do all the state conference work for the policy development for the 1974 state conference. So, yeah, I learned how to work very hard.
You didn't need the experience because you were about to get all of
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Your calendar must have been so packed.
Well, I don't even think back to it because we did it. We just did it. And, it was still dominated by men back then. Mm. Pretty much, and because the trade unions were all in the building at Trades Hall, which was in Beaufort Street, and we were in the throes then of building Curtin House, which became next door, and we moved up onto the 8th floor of that about 19... And Gough actually opened the building probably the beginning of either mid-74 or early 75 is my recollection of that. So, yeah, I mean, it was exciting times.
Mm. You mentioned there about there still being obviously a lot of men dominating that space.
Yeah.
How many women are we talking at that time, how many women were you working with?
In our office, there were two juniors and women, and an accountant who was a woman, and me. That was it.
Did you all get together for lunch? Was that the time to catch up?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Yep. And, yeah, I mean, it was happy offers. You know, we didn't even think about it. That's just how it was because party had no money. Mm. So, you know, and we probably actually worked a lot of extra hours than, you know, we were paid for because that's the way it was to get stuff done.
Did you ever think of it like invisible work at that point? Because that's the whole idea of that. Yeah. That's that concept, isn't it? Of you work all these hours without being paid or compensated.
No, we just, it was the way it was, and you did it for the love of what you were involved in, basically.
Mm. Cheryl, if we had a dollar for every time that somebody did something for the love of it and not to be compensated, I reckon we'd never have to work again.
That's right. Absolutely right.
Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit here. Talk to me about the first time that you found yourself running in an election.
Well, what you've missed there is the fact that I actually went off to, when I left the ALP, I actually went to work for Senator Patricia Giles, who was one of the first women senators in Western Australia. Mm-hmm. And I learnt so much from I never say I worked for her, I worked with her because that's the way she wanted it and that's the way it was. So she taught me lots. And in terms of me running for election, I had to be dragged kicking and screaming because I never thought I was good enough because I left school when I was 15 and I didn't have any tertiary qualifications. And I just thought, no, I can't do this, even though I'd been involved by that time in policy development, both at the federal and state levels. And, you know, I had some pretty great mentors from the blokes who said to me, you're the next senior woman and, you know, up to you. You've got to think about it. We're giving you a week to think it through and we want you to put your hand up.
A week.
Yes, by that time I was a supporting parent with an eight-year-old who I took care of because I did actually get into Murdoch Uni and as a mature age student in 1987 and 1988. But once I got pre-selected, you know, something had to go because I just didn't have enough time to fit everything in. And, of course, that's what went was the tertiary qualification. And I'd been doing really well. I was pre-selected for the seat of South Metropolitan Region on the ticket. It was the first of the regions that election. And I was number three on the ticket. And I participated in running the assembly campaigns because that's how you do it when you're an upper house member. You help the lower house people to run their campaigns. And unfortunately, the seat that I was involved in primarily was the seat of Riverton, which had a terrific woman who was the deputy mayor of the city of Canning, and she only missed out by about 1.5% of winning that seat. So, but it was when Labor was starting to be on the slide and Peter Dowding was actually the Premier after Brian Burke had retired. And so that was pretty sad that Marilyn didn't, Marilyn Crispin was her name, that Marilyn didn't get up. And then I had to wait 6 weeks to know whether or not I'd actually won that seat because it was, you know, it was just hand counting back then. And because our figures had dropped, it took a while to know whether or not I was actually elected. So that was all hard to cope with, about knowing what's going to happen with your future.
After such a narrow loss in the seat of Riverton, what was going through your mind once the votes had come in and you found out you were elected?
Well, how do I get on with my life here now? I've because I was living in the northern suburbs at the time, and I'm a very firm believer that you need to live with the people that you represent. So I actually had to sell my house in the northern suburbs and move south, you know, kind of get my son into a local primary school. And I had to think really hard about that too because he was so young and I thought I can't be too far away from him if I've got to get hauled out of Parliament to get to him. Mm. So I actually moved to Como initially and then it was later on that I moved to Vic Park.
It's that classic thing of when the school calls you and your kid is sick, you need to come pick them up.
Exactly.
You have to step out of question time, but
and fortunately, I mean, I didn't have many occasions where I had to do that, but I needed to know that I was there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the first year that I was elected, my mother died at the end of that year, so that was pretty traumatic as well. And because after my dad died 20 years earlier, I mean, she'd been an amazing support, still living in North Dandenong. But, you know, essentially, she'd come up during school holidays and stuff like that. But essentially, I did it pretty much by myself. And to be fair, my ex-husband, actually, he certainly took good part in his son's upbringing.
Sure.
But it's much better if your gran can be around. And he certainly, my ex-husband, didn't have any parents left. So she played. He was only 12 when Mum died. So, you know, he at least had some time with her, which was terrific.
You mentioned there about some pretty important women in the West Australian political history, about Madeleine Crispin and about Patricia Giles as well. Yeah. What was the political rhetoric like for women at the time when you were elected, when you first entered politics? Were there many other women around?
No. By that time, we were starting to actually recruit. By that time, Jackie Watkins in Wanneroo, Pam Beggs in Whitford, Yvonne Henderson in Gosnells, Kay Hallahan in the Upper House, Carmen Lawrence. And I came in 89. So there wasn't too many of us back then, but we all had a pretty good relationship. But at the local level, we were starting to really recruit women. And in the lead up to the Burke government, we developed some fantastic policy on the social development, community development front that we were able to implement in those first years of government. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we were coming, there's no doubt about that. And it was, there was a bit of resentment from the blokes, not so much the Labor blokes, but, you know, we weren't taken all that seriously by some of the others. But, you know, I never had any real trouble. I could call them out.
Sure.
If, you know, if they started to get, you know, a bit out of line, so to speak.
Sometimes when I watch Question Time in Parliament now and you hear people throw things around and it feels careless and it's obviously not, it's quite rehearsed. But I imagine in the early days when women were really starting to hold their own in the Parliament, some of the things that would have been said would never be able to be televised now. I'm not going to ask you to repeat them, but do you recall that being a thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially when I did the abortion law reform. And I did that as a backbencher in opposition. And it was a conscience vote. So some of my own colleagues were dreadful. And some of the things that they threw at me were pretty, pretty gross. And one particular thing that comes to mind, when we were doing the committee stage, one of my own threw at me about, you know, how I didn't care about unborn children and one thing and another. And I was lucky because I was actually allowed to have a woman doctor who'd worked in this field for many years, who was part of our team. And she was just horrified at what was being said. She said, "You have to say something about this." And I just knew. I said, "Look, just let it sit for the moment. I will when I respond." And I was able to actually get up and say, and shut them up for at least 2.5 hours, was that I'd actually lost a child at six and a half months. And to say what they'd said to me was totally uncalled for. And, you know, I had experienced trauma in relation to, you know, having a child and losing a child. So, you know, this was not about women being, you know, frivolous. This was actually about women making choices and not having to worry about being put in jail for making those choices. All the medicos that were doing the terminations having to suffer the consequences. So, yeah, I mean, that was pretty horrific. And some of those people that I actually served with, particularly in my own party, those friendships were never repaired. And I have no regrets about that whatsoever, because they deserved what I said.
The bill you're talking about is a private member's bill from 1998, when you're in shadow government, when you're in the opposition, to remove abortion from the criminal code.
Yes.
That is such a revolutionary, and at the time, I imagine, quite a an unheard of, to some people, quite a terrifying thing to even utter those words in a chamber. Before you actually get to the point of standing up and introducing that bill, what led you to that moment? You've already mentioned there about some of your own personal history and personal trauma.
Yeah, well, for me, it was about working with Pat Giles. It was about joining the Association for the Legal Right to Abortion in Western Australia. And I'd done all that before I even got to Parliament. I didn't go into Parliament not to make a difference. And for me, this was something that really needed to be done. I made my first speech in 1989 on this issue. And then when the doctors were actually charged in 1998, I got the opportunity, and it was really interesting because the Attorney General at the time, Peter Foss, who I have to say was incredibly supportive of me in terms of doing this legislation, he said to me, "Oh, why don't you just let the Greens do it?" And I said, "No, how could I? After I've actually made my first speech on it, I know I'm probably the one person in this parliament knows more about it than anyone else. Why would I do that?"
Sure.
And so that's kind of, you know, how it happened. And, you know, I mean, rest's history. It took us 4 months to get it through, and it was pretty tough going. And, of course, we had to accept the amendments to get it through. And, you know, as I say, it went in there with three sections: removal of Section 199, 200 and 201 of the Criminal Code. And that was it. But to get it through, we had to make compromises, which is often what you have to do in politics. Mm. And, you know, a lot of people were not happy about that. But they also wanted the change. So, I mean, you know, the group that was around me, some of them weren't terribly happy about it, but they realised that we weren't going to save the doctors and it was going to be terrible for women if it, you know, we stopped the access, which was illegal anyway. We had to do it. So that's what happened.
For those of us who are maybe too young to remember or weren't around at the time, what was the situation like with accessing safe abortion in WA?
Well, there were only two clinics. There's still only two clinics, effectively. But the doctors that actually worked in those clinics were doing, because it was only surgical abortions then, because we didn't have RU486, which are the medical terminations, which we now have. But one of the things we slipped in that legislation and got through, which Peter Foss and I were responsible for, was to actually get medical terminations in there. Nobody even debated that.
The irony of not even bothering to figure it out.
Know what it was. I mean, you know, that was quite a coup, actually.
Stick the needle in.
Yeah. And then, of course, we had Tony Abbott federally, who along with Brian Harradine, wouldn't pass the law to actually allow RU486 to be legal in Australia. So all of that stuff took such a long time.
It was a conscience vote when this went to Parliament here in WA. In more recent times, when I think of conscience votes, I think of the same-sex marriage bill.
Yep.
Something that's on the cards in the coming year here in Australia will be the voice to Parliament.
Yep.
Both of those things publicly have already had such ugly and hurtful campaigns around them. Irreparable damage has been done to people involved in those campaigns. What was it like publicly at the time when you introduced this bill? And I'm sure the news picked it up and ran with it.
Well, in fact, the media, to some degree, were on side, pretty much. They didn't, I mean, so many of the young journalists didn't even realise that it wasn't legal. And I got some fantastic support from the media for what I was doing. I mean, we had the Right to Lifers and, you know, they were just horrendous, horrible. What's very interesting now, as I see that what's being put forward in relation to the new bill, is there's hardly any kind of anti-response. It'll happen in the Parliament. There's a couple in the upper house males who will fight, you know, to the nth degree to try and stop it. But fortunately, and there's still some on our own side that aren't on the same wavelength, they'll be there. But essentially, the really good thing is that Labor's got such a majority, it'll go through. And it needs to, because ours is now way behind every other state, whereas when I did it, it was the most progressive in the country.
Mm.
And that's 25 years ago.
Do you think if there were more women in the parliament, it wouldn't have been such a dogfight?
Some of the women, especially the Conservative women, they opposed it. There was only one Liberal woman and one Conservative Liberal in the Assembly who actually supported it. So there is still, you know, women that don't, well, I don't know whether they don't understand it, but they don't support it.
Well, I guess as well, it's a lot of people still want to frame it as a women's issue, and yeah. It's not just a women's
issue.
It's
not.
Yeah.
It's everybody's issue.
It's a human issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a human right. And, you know, there were so few women in the parliament at the time that, you know, that was always going to be an issue. But, and I had some, you know, terrific support from June van der Klaashorst, who was a member of Swan Hills, and of course on our own side we had Michelle Roberts who didn't support it. All the other Labor women did, which was terrific. But I never ever, you know, had horrible relationship with Michelle because of it, which I'm very grateful for. But it was the men that were the worst, who never have to experience it anyway. Which is, you know, the sad part of it all.
It's such an interesting one because it affects so many people, whether they publicise it or not. I imagine you would have heard some pretty horrific stories while doing the research and putting the policy and putting it forward.
I did.
You would think that would be enough to make people reconsider their feelings
about
the issue.
Well, what was really interesting that we got in my electorate office, we got a huge number of Conservative women ringing us who'd had relative who'd actually, you know, had the old knitting needle or whatever that they'd had to experience. And they rang me up and said, please, who do you want us to go and see on our side to help you get this through?
Wow.
Which I thought was pretty amazing. I mean, there was support right across the board because these women had actually had personal experiences with their own families way back when. It was all men in the parliaments around the country. You know, even then we'd actually had two Conservative doctors in the parliament who'd tried to change the law, and we had Roy Claughton, who was a member for North Metropolitan in the Labor Party, who tried to do it back in the early 70s, and, you know, they all got knocked back. But Roy went on to be the inaugural president of the Family Planning Association, you know, and he was still alive when I did the law reform, and it was just wonderful for people like him to actually see that it had finally been achieved. So, yeah, I mean, it's not that people didn't try, it's just that, you know, the churches were still very prominent in relation to it. Even back when I did it, the Catholic Church was pretty prominent and, you know, camped out in the Labor Whip's office in the Assembly.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. The bishop's big day out.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been 25 years since that law has been reformed now, thanks to you, Cheryl. How are you feeling, and how do you sit with the state of accessing abortion in WA in today's context?
Well, it's still very difficult because I still have quite a lot of contact with Dr. Victor Chan, who is the doctor that was originally charged. And, you know, he still had to contend with issues from the health department about registration and things like that for Nanyara, his clinic. And, I mean, you know, the sooner this legislation goes through and he doesn't have to contend with some of the things are so nitpicky, you just wonder if there's a right to life in there, You know, I mean, I can't say that categorically, but I wonder.
I love that you call them right-to-lifers.
Yeah, well, that's what they called the association.
It's like a gang.
And, yeah, pretty much it was. You know, if anything, whenever something goes wrong, I still get the phone call from him. And, you know, will I talk to the minister, or will I do this, or will I do that? And, you know, happy to do it, of course I am. But I shouldn't have to be doing that 25 years later. It should have, you know, it should have been fixed. And fortunately, Amber Jade Sanderson, you know, they're going to announce it today in the first sitting, the actual list of bills that are going to be dealt with this year, and that's one of them. And I've been urging all the new members in there, to women members in particular, I said, get this done for the 22nd of May, which will be 25 years since my legislation went through the Parliament.
That is a deadline to meet, absolutely, and such a special one to meet,
absolutely,
too.
Yeah.
The challenge is on, ladies of Labor. Yeah. There's a lot of
them
now.
And, I mean, you know, it's really interesting because that 22nd of May was the actual date when I first entered the Parliament.
So but significant all round.
It is, absolutely, from my perspective.
Songlines is a new RTRFM podcast shining a light on First Nations artists across WA. Join me, Cesara Krishnaz, as I sit down with creatives across music, theatre, dance and television, paving the way for the next generation of storytellers. Stream now on iTunes, Spotify and rtrfm.com.au.
I just want to press pause on Australian politics for a moment, and I just want to get your thoughts on something that's happened internationally. In the last 12 months, we've seen some horrific things happen in the US. Roe v. Wade has been overturned, which is their right to access safe and legal abortion. And as a lot of us learnt for the first time, their laws are so varied state to state, some of them scarily. How are you feeling as somebody who worked so intensely and so significantly in that space? How were you feeling when the news eventually broke about Roe v. Wade overturning?
Well, I'm very pleased that we have a Westminster system of parliament, that we don't have the American parliamentary system, because most states, even in the US, are different to each other, as well as they're certainly different to all the Australian states. So, I mean, that's one thing we can be very grateful for. But yeah, I do fear for American women. And I only heard last night, I went to a lecture that Anne Summers was doing here, and she was saying that in some of the states, some of the Republican governors actually want to register when a woman's pregnant. I mean,
who's got the time?
And what about the privacy? I mean, what right have they got to do things like that? Yeah, so, I mean, thank God we don't live there. It's really scary. And I'm very, very happy we live in Australia and we have such a decent system of government. I mean, it's tough at times, there's no doubt about that. But in the context of future and the fact now that all the states have actually done what they've done, and, you know, when you say about, you know, will, I really don't think that the apology will be a conscience vote. It's always been euthanasia, abortion, prostitution, things like that, that have been the conscience vote.
Yeah, it'll be a referendum, the voice to Parliament, won't it?
Yeah, it will.
Cheryl, when did you leave politics? When was your final sort of moment of sitting and what led you to the decision?
I left in 2001. Gallup government got elected. And I thought through, I could have stayed, but the thing for me was I knew I wasn't going to be a minister because I was in the upper house and we only have a couple in the upper house, and I just thought, being a backbencher in government, I'd done what I came to do. I don't want to sit on the backbench and have to shut up. I just think that I can go off and do other things, which I've basically done. in the last 20 years. And I've had a pretty good life post politics. I was in an active ageing task force for the Gallup government. I did a work-life balance committee in the Department of Health for Jim McGuinty, chaired a childcare advisory committee for Sue Ellery, a few things like that. And then in 2011 to 2013, I actually went and was the chief advisor to the government of Norfolk Island, which was amazing. Hardest thing I ever did in politics.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're so, it was like stepping back into the 1950s.
Oh, my gosh.
And because, there's a real, they basically want Australia to give them a bucket of money and they can do whatever they want with it. And, of course, that's never going to happen. I was part of their territory government that was actually trying to bring in a roadmap to get them back under Australian Social Security and or immigration laws and Medicare, which they didn't have. Now, since I left, they've been sacked. Tony Abbott sacked them totally. So they're now just a local government.
Mm.
They've already been sacked by the New South Wales, who did all their state services. And I think Queensland have taken them on now. But it was just...
It's like the Wild West.
It was, yeah. There was a lot of Pitcairn descendants who, they have this view that Queen Victoria gave them the island after the second penal colony from Australia left, which is not true. It was just that it was an empty island and a place for them to go, which was 6,000 kilometres from where they came from. And it's just, they've never really gotten that out of their mind. It was the most fascinating experience, and I got to live down in the World Heritage area, and I was over there for 2 years. It was a very beautiful place. I made some wonderful friends. For the first 12 months, I kept my head down because I thought, well, it's better they don't know my history.
Mm.
And it was very interesting. First time we went to Canberra to talk to the ministers, my chief minister on Norfolk and the minister that came with us. It was so funny because all these people kept coming out of doors and engulfing me, and saying hello, and because I've been around for a while. And they actually finally realised that I had some clout.
You were a big deal.
That I could basically get in touch with people that they couldn't and talk to them. So that was really interesting. But my chief minister and I, in the beginning, he went around me a bit, but then he realised that he couldn't do that and that we needed to have a really close relationship, otherwise there was no point in me being there. There was an election 2 years later and my chief minister got beaten by one vote.
Oh, my gosh.
And, we were well on the way to getting that roadmap implemented. And I just thought, I stayed on for two and a half months and it was just hopeless because, the Maddies got in power and there was just no point in staying. So I came home. But yeah, it was an interesting time. We set up a really progressive women's group while I was over there, which was great fun. And I've maintained, friendships over there. They've just had a cyclone, Category 2, that one that's gone to New Zealand. And I've been in touch with a couple of my mates over there. They've survived because it split in the middle and passed over them.
Oh.
And so they didn't get the 200-kilometre... winds that have been predicted. Yeah, so they have survived. But yeah, I've been very lucky in terms of, my post-parliament. And I made the choice to leave, and so I have no regrets whatsoever. And I've done really interesting things since I left.
You've done very interesting things, very busy things. I wanted to ask about that transition post-political life, not working those 60-hour-a-week kind of weeks, but it sounds like you were just as busy.
Well, I was, but not to the degree of we had to be, all of those kind of things. And I'm even more, hampered at the moment because I was diagnosed with epilepsy, earlier this year, and so I can't drive at the moment, which is a pain in the bum because that's taken away a bit more independence. But, yeah, I mean, you know, life happens and so you cope with it.
What is it that keeps you busy these days? What's the thing that's taking most of your attention, Cheryl?
My garden.
Great answer.
I love gardening. I've only got a small unit and so I've got pot plants everywhere. And I try to grow vegetables in pots and stuff like that. I read quite a lot and I've been having a few problems with my eyes at the moment, but, still on the computer and in touch with people, that kind of stuff. But I guess, you know, am I still busy? I'm not so busy in the context of doing the mentoring I used to do. I mean, what I didn't talk about in there was Emily's List, which I co-chaired with Joan Kerner when we set that up. And we set that up in 1996, and we've now achieved virtually 50% women. And we did it out, even though we supported Labor women, we did it outside the Labor Party, and we've now almost got 50% in every Labor caucus, state and federal, across the nation.
Well, I did want to ask about this as sort of a final note to leave on, is about women entering into politics, and there are often barriers, sometimes visible, sometimes invisible. That's something that you obviously noticed, which is where Emily's List started.
Yep.
For folks who maybe have heard that name or don't know much about it, what was the whole idea behind Emily's List?
Well, the whole idea was that we would train, mentor and fundraise for women in particular. And the mentoring was incredibly important. And in the early days, I was the first election that we dealt with was the South Australian election in, I think, about 97. And I went to South Australia and trained six women, and they all got up,
wow.
And which was fantastic. We raised quite a lot of money and they got in government.
It's 100% strike rate.
Yeah, it was. It was terrific. And we showed them, you know, how to manage the people they worked with. Policies. Policy was, you know, such a big thing. The parties are much, party officers and so forth and organisers are much better at it now than what they were back then. I mean, we're talking 25 years ago. And, I mean, Joan Kerner was the most fantastic person to work with. And then I took over from Helen 4 years later and I'd left Parliament by then. And, you know, I went all over the country. And Joan would say, OK, we're doing good cop, bad cop. And most of the time she was good cop and I was bad cop. But we had some great success.
Hang on, you need to tell me what good cop, bad cop is. What do
well,
you mean?
Well, you know, when you needed to tell ministers and male members of parliament what they were doing wrong, and, you know, how they had to manage various women and one thing and another. Yeah, I mean, it was tough. And the mentoring, you know, to help those women back on track after dealing with us. And some of the leaders were quite hostile towards us because we, you know, we weren't being told by them.
Well, you were bad cop.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the original workplace HR seminar.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. And they needed to actually get up to speed that if you were going to have women in your caucus, you needed to actually understand that they're not the same as you and that there are other ways to manage that you get the best out of them that you possibly can.
A few things before we wrap up, Cheryl. For women listening who are thinking, I really want to make a change and I think I can do that by running for Parliament. I know that you've been asked this many, many times, but what's the piece of advice you give to those women?
Not to be frightened, to get the right advice and to get the right mentoring. And that's one thing that Emily's List has done. We get mentors from around Australia. You know, you don't just mentor in your own state, you mentor women from other states. which is really good because they can be very honest about what they're facing and then how to manage that. The mentor can actually go to the people they need to actually talk it through.
A few more things. In 2016, you were inducted to the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast is a look at the lives and the careers, the ups and downs of women who've been inducted to the Hall of Fame, and it makes total sense why you have been put in there amongst so many other women. What was the feeling like when you got the phone call and said, we'd like to add you to the list?
Pretty good, because it was quite a long time after I'd done the major thing in my political career. So, yeah, it was nice to be recognised in that way. And I mean, you know, I was only looking the other day at all these awards that I've got from various places in frames and thinking, what am I ever going to do with all of these? It's a bit scary. And, of course, all my stuff from the abortion debate is in the Batty Library, so I've dealt with. There's still one box that I haven't put in because it's still a bit contentious to do yet. I've said to my son that's where I want it to end up. But, I mean, in the context of awards, it's, yeah, a lot of the community organisations that I've been involved have actually had awards that they've given me, which is fantastic.
Mm. Your impact has been, it's, you can't quite put into context the impact that you've had, Cheryl, and I know that you know that, but still, it's important to say it.
I never think about it in that context. Because, you know, I think about the fact that I'm that little 15-year-old girl that graduated from Pinjarra High School and never, ever imagined that I would have the career that I've had, ever.
We're very thankful for it. Our final question, and I don't want to put you on the spot, and no pressure. We're a radio station. We love music. We play a lot of music. If you had to pick one Cheryl Davenport anthem, what would it be?
It would be, it's from Carmen, the opera, the Toreador's March.
That is the best answer. And you knew it straight away.
Oh, absolutely. It's on my phone.
Is it your ringtone?
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. And love it. Love that opera. I just love that piece of music.
I'm so thankful you said that. Cheryl Davenport, thank you for being part of Herstory.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks to Cheryl Davenport and all the women at the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Sophie Minisale and Madeline Lombardi are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast is produced on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. Join us next week as we conclude Season 2 with the woman who has championed the rights of First Nations people in her community.
From UFO sightings to abandoned theme parks and tank rampages across the CBD, Planet Perth is your guide to the weird, wacky and unexplained history of our eccentric city. Planet Perth. Stream now on iTunes, Spotify and rtrfm.com.au.